Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Brian Lehrer Show is not live today, so we won't be taking any calls. But we thought we'd take this opportunity to bring you some of our favorite recent segments. So enjoy, and remember that our comments page is always open. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and his wife, former Times reporter and editor Cheryl Wudunn, have a new book, make that manifesto, about fighting international gender inequality. It's called Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. And they join me now to talk about why the solution to some of the world's most intractable problems of hunger, poverty, and disease lie in women's hands. They join me now. Welcome back to WNYC, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn.
Thank you.
You write in the book that your conversion as a couple to the cause of international women's rights came after Tiananmen Square, when you realized the sheer numbers of crimes against women that went unremarked upon. Cheryl, can you talk about that?
Yeah, actually, when we were in Tiananmen Square, we were amazed at how much attention the crackdown got. And, of course, it's terrible.
You lived in China. You were covering China at the time,
absolutely.
Right?
We were there, and it was stunning to us. I mean, it's terrible that kids were killed, and we still, you know, were horrified by it. We knew some of them. But what we found the following year is when we started roaming the countryside and digging deeply into some of the issues there, we discovered that, in fact, there were many, many millions of missing girls in China, partly because of, you know, female infanticide, but also because of sex-selective abortion. Families were discovering that the sonogram was able to let them tell, oh, we don't want a girl, so let's abort her before she's even born. And that was happening so that there were basically 30 million missing girls from the population.
How early can a sonogram tell you that? Do you know?
You know, up until certainly the end of the first early second trimester, we don't really know exactly when these abortions throughout the term were taking place, but they were taking place on a mass level.
And, Nick, you liken the cause of women's rights to fighting slavery and totalitarianism and say it's the cause of this century. With the Civil War and Cold War, there were heavy costs to those battles. Do you accept the same in this expect the same in this struggle?
No. I mean, we can – this is a war we can fight with many fewer losses. And the British really led the fight against slavery, for example. And they paid a significant price for that. They lost 1.6 percentage points of their GNP each year for 60 years. And I really admire them. It was really because of the British that the global slave trade was ended. And this is something that we can do, and it will help fight poverty, help fight extremism, and we won't have to pay a huge price.
About the missing girls, let me dig in on that a little bit more, because your book was excerpted in a special edition of the Sunday New York Times Magazine, and one of the other articles in that issue pointed to the fact that economic development around the world has not ended the missing girls phenomenon, either in India or in China. So is economic development not sufficient to make women matter more?
Oh, you're right. This is a long-term process. Economic development certainly helps as households and villages and counties start to see the value that women can bring to their economy. It takes a long time. Even in China, where we first learned about this problem, we've seen enormous economic development there as well. And I think that the issues are abating in terms of the prejudice against women, but these are century-old habits.
And from fighting totalitarianism and covering Tiananmen Square, Nick, you actually look at China now in the book as an example of how social change, empowering women, is possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tendency is to think of this as an issue of justice, that you know, there are more women enslaved in brothels now than there were people transferred each year into the slave plantations. But I think maybe the argument that actually gets more traction in a lot of countries is not that it's morally wrong to treat women unfairly, but rather that if you want to develop, if you want to fight poverty, you can't do it if you don't tap the resources of half your population. And China is a remarkable example of a country that went from extreme prejudice against women, extreme constraints, where you had, you know, foot binding, concubinage, child marriage, to a place where women actually play a major role in the labor force. And that is why China has prospered.
And you're running a contest on your New York Times blog asking people to write in with examples of women's empowerment. And one of the early comments starts like this: I live in a third world country. You know it as Detroit. Why doesn't anyone care about poverty and the disproportionate burden it puts on women here at home?
Look, these are global issues, and they certainly echo here in the U.S. And we do need to be more concerned with poverty, education, the role of women in the U.S. But there really is a difference. In some countries in Africa, women has a 1 chance in 7 lifetime risk of dying in childbirth. In the U.S., if I remember right, it's 1 in
47,000. Oh, 2,800. Yeah, you're right.
You know, there are real issues of sex trafficking here, but India has several million girls who are locked up in brothels. We can do more than one thing at the same time, and we certainly need to worry about Detroit, but we at the same time can't forget about girls locked up in brothels in India.
Paresa in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Did I say your name right?
Yes, Paresa. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I love your show.
Thank you.
I actually am originally from Iran. I was born there. I have a graduate degree here in the States, and most of my cousins either doctorates or have graduate degrees in Iran and are unable to get jobs along with the rest of the young adult population in Iran, but much more disproportionately compared to the men. And again, more than half of college graduates in Iran are women, and more than half of those enrolled are women as well. And it just goes to show that there is still so much oppression going on in that country. Some of the fighting and the protests that have been going on in the past few months was actually pulled together and organized by women who are fed up with not being able to get the jobs they deserve.
Cheryl, yeah. Do you write about Iran, particularly in the book?
We write about a lot of the Muslim countries, and it is a very, very tough issue because in addition to Iran and Saudi Arabia, these are countries that educate their women. So clearly education is not enough. These countries have to accept women into the workforce, into the labor force, and say that they are the most productive members. They can be one of the most productive members of society. And if our countries are going to increase their GDP, let's turn to some women.
Paresa, thank you very much. But the first comment on our website for this interview was from someone objecting to the fact that the Muslim world seems to be singled out for criticism. And you do have a whole chapter on whether or not Islam is misogynistic.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think that one of the things we don't often talk about is this very widespread perception that in Muslim countries, women are second-class citizens. And so that's why we have that chapter. And I think it is important to address. And the answer is sort of complicated. There are some Muslim countries where women indeed really are given opportunities and brought into the labor force. And there's been tremendous improvements. And, Bangladesh is an interesting example of that, with more girls in high school now than boys. And I think that's one reason why Pakistan today is a lot more why Bangladesh is much more promising today than Pakistan. But it is true also that if you look at countries where girls and women aren't given opportunities and run into a lot of problems, then they are disproportionately Muslim, conservative Muslim countries.
And I think Nita in Manhattan wants to say kind of on this theme, but expand it to other religions. Correct, Nita?
Yes. Hi, Nita. World religions, the major religions, not just Islam. You can start right here in the United States and take it all around the world. I spend lots of time in Asia. It's not just Islam. It's Buddhism, the original religion I love. You know, it's all of these religions. It's that I see as a source of retaining the oppression on women, because until their role within the religions change, not within the social area around the religions, but within the religious hierarchies, mm-hmm. until those change, including Catholicism, obviously, and all of the other religions in the West. But until those change, most of the world, unfortunately, is religious, in my opinion, and this is going to affect them if it changes.
Nita, thank you. And Cheryl, in the book, you talk about working with the Catholic Church and with the evangelicals. So it's not just Islam, but is Nita, speaking a global truth as far as you're concerned?
Look, these issues are far more complicated than one can say in one sentence. And it is true that there are hierarchical relationships within religions, and that's not a great thing. At the same time, a lot of these religious organizations have also been at the forefront of helping aid some of these women in Africa, throughout Africa, in other parts of the world as well. And so it is complicated.
Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun, husband, wife, co-authors, my guest on WNYC, as we talk about their new book, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Sarah in Rego Park, you're on WNYC. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, thanks. I love your show.
Thank you.
When I was studying in graduate school 20 years ago, we learned a lot about the Grameen Bank and microlending. And it made an impression on me that the microlenders love lending to women and choose to lend to women because they are more responsible and tend to repay the loans and tend to use the loans and the money to better their communities, starting with their very own family and children. That point has always stuck with me. Women are more socially conscious, I think, especially when they're as poor and downtrodden as many of them are, and will take any opportunity to better their community and not merely themselves.
This is kind of the dirty little secret of development that isn't talked about very much. But one of the reasons for a lot of the worst suffering is not just really low incomes, but also some really bad spending decisions. And those are, frankly, disproportionately by men. If you look at – in the book, we look at how the poorest families all across the world spend their incomes. And on average, they spend about 2% of their incomes on education, which is a real positive net economic return. It's a great investment. In contrast, they spend about 20% of their incomes on a combination of alcohol, cigarettes, prostitution, sugary drinks, extravagant festivals. And if you could just reduce that 20% to, say, 16% and take that extra 4 percentage points and add that to education, that would be utterly transformative. And one way to do that is to put more spending power in the hands of women.
And so is that gender-related, or is it – also an indication of a problem with men's roles? If there are no jobs for men, do they seek to escape their worries? Or even if they do have jobs, they're more likely to squander these investment funds.
Even if they have jobs, when they do get income, when men control the purse strings, they're more likely to spend incomes in ways that are related to consumption, less to investment, especially investment in children.
And so as a preemptive strike, what are you going to say to the 20 posts we're about to get on our website calling you sexist?
There's abundant evidence for this and from a wide variety of cultures, Indonesia, South Africa, Liberia, that when women have more control over the purse strings, then their children grow taller, get more education, are less likely to be malnourished. I think it's Liberia, there was one good study that where there are men's crops and women's crops, and they're different. And when the men's crops have a good year and the men get more income, more money is spent on beer. When women's crops do well and the women get more spending power, then more money is spent on education.
You also do give policy advice to President Obama. What would you like to see the United States do, Cheryl, at a policy level?
Well, I think that certainly Secretary Clinton's trip to the Congo was a really great step because I don't think any other Secretary of State has been to Goma. She's highlighting the issues which need to be highlighted to put pressure on the local governments. And it's the same thing with India. I think obviously there are laws that we need to pass, and there are steps towards trying to push through the International Violence Against Women's Act. But, ultimately, it has to come from the bottom up. Ultimately, the people have to care enough for political will to move the needle.
Yeah, we looked at a variety of social changes over the years in Half the Sky. And we really came to the conclusion that the way you get real change is with social movements. And there is one that is beginning on behalf of women around the world. We hope Half the Sky will help nurture it a little bit. We started a website called halfthesskymovement.org, and it hopefully will function a little bit as a do-it-yourself toolkit to encourage people to not only inform themselves but actually to get active.
And you have some very specific policy suggestions in the Times article in the magazine, $10 billion for girls' education, iodized salt, and to eradicate obstetric fistula.
Right.
Yeah. Let's take iodized salt, because that's something nobody has ever heard of. We don't think of that as a gender issue, and in a sense it isn't. But we think of lack of iodine as something that causes goiters. In fact, in much of the world, there are a few people who suffer goiters, but the larger problem is that a very large proportion of children in utero, if they don't get enough iodine from their mothers, then they lose about 10 to 15 IQ points, and that is a permanent loss. Their brains don't form properly, and this, for some reason, is particularly true of female fetuses over male. And it is so cheap. It costs a couple of cents a year to iodize salt, which essentially all people have, all people buy. It's the one thing that people buy. And it would have a radical difference in so many poor countries.
It's amazing. This is something that most Americans would have never, ever given a thought to. And last thing, you have people-to-people suggestions. Forget about the governments. People-to-people loans like Kiva. Sponsor an individual girl or a woman. Email updates. The relief agency CARE has an action network.
Exactly. These are the kinds of things that individuals can take steps towards. I mean, our idea is that it's kind of do-it-yourself foreign aid. Look, foreign aid is a complicated topic, but you actually can take a step that has a meaningful impact on a girl in Cambodia who can't afford $7 to buy her books for the year. There are so many different steps that one can take. You just have to say, what foe do I care about? Do I care about trafficking? Do I care about maternal mortality? Do I care about rape? Choose one. And then choose the country that you care about. Do I care about Congo? Do I care about Cambodia or India? And then choose the organization that you want to work with. So it's just a very simple series of three, four steps.
Some difficult realities. Nicholas, this is what you do in your column. Week after week, you confront us with difficult realities that it would be too easy to look away from. And here are many stories of individuals, again, as you do in the column, told in this book, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn are the authors, and they managed to share a household, too. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.